This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This is The Literary Life. I'm Mitchell Kaplan. I've owned books and books and been a bookseller for over 35 years. What you're about to hear are conversations about all things literary, with writers, readers, publishers, old friends, new friends, and anyone who might wander into our store with an interesting story to tell about their connection to books, reading, or writing. These will be informal, over-the-backyard-fence kind of conversations, the kind I and booksellers everywhere have each and every day. All right, I want to bring on John Grisham. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Mitch.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Good. And that was going to, I was going to ask you, how are you when in the middle of all this crazy pandemic stuff? You and your family are fine, I hope.
We are fine. We live in Central Virginia. We live on a farm way out in the country, so we're sort of quarantined by nature, and we've taken it very serious. This is a university town, so people here got behind it early on. We have not been hit hard yet. We have some really good hospitals, great doctors and nurses, and so far we have just not seen a lot of cases, but we're still very, very protective and worried like everybody else.
Yeah, well, that's how we are in South Florida. You know, we're in the middle of tourism land, and you know, so many people came to the beaches right before, and we're still seeing some climb on some of our cases. The rest of Florida is not, but South Florida is still under quarantine. All of our stores are still closed, although our online stores are open, and we're starting to do some curbside service in our restaurants as well.
Yeah, well, hang in there. There's so many bookstores that are closed, so many that are just probably will not reopen. And, you know, we're just fighting it and trying to hang on.
Well, I wanted to get to that later on. I mean, you've been such a friend of indie bookstores. I mean, it's legendary. When you were living in Mississippi most of the time, you know, Richard from Square Books and Johnny Evans from Lemuria, and the way you supported those guys was just so heartening. Well, what is your feeling? How do you feel about indie stores, and what is the meaning of bookstores to you?
It goes back to 1989 when I published A Time to Kill, and I was unknown. The book was unknown. The publisher was small and unknown, and most big bookstores chains did not have time for an unknown author. But there were five stores sort of in the Memphis Jackson area that opened up for me. My first book signing was at Square Books. In June of 1989, Richard opened the store, and we sold 44 books that day, and we were happy with that. Johnny had me in Jackson, Reeds had me in Tupelo, Burks had me in Memphis, and Mary Gay had me in Blytheville. Those five stores really pushed the books big time. And when the firm came out a couple years later, suddenly all the big stores wanted me to, you know, stop by, but I didn't have a lot of time. And for years, I went back to those five stores every year. We would sell 2,000 books, 3,000 books in one day, and had some marathon signings. I finally got kind of tired of that. I still signed books for all of them every year, so they have plenty, but it was those independent bookstores and across the country. Independent bookstores are crucial for debut writers because they get behind a book and they hand sell it. And your indies know the product, they know the writers, they know the publishers, they read, so they know, you know, good books when they see them, they know what's coming, and they recommend them to their customers and they hand sell them. And we've lost so many independents in the past 30 years, and they were making a comeback in numbers until this thing hit. So it's gonna be hard to come back, but you know, we're always gonna have books and writers and great bookstores like yours.
I think you're absolutely right. I think who knows how we'll look on the other side of this, but there are always gonna be places where people want to go. It's funny, I always talk about the fact that indie bookstores
we have a pre-existing condition. We have a comorbidity when it comes to this virus, because we're all about drawing people to us. We're all about congregating. We're all about having people in for author events and discussions and all of that. And that's exactly what this virus thrives on.
Yeah.
So it's making us, it's in 24 hours, it turned us all into virtual booksellers. So we're doing stuff like this.
Yeah, and we hope, Mitch, that because of the isolation, because of the distancing, because of all the stuff that we're going through, that people will read and need books and still support the bookstores, buy more, read more. You know, we hope that's going to happen. Selfishly, sure, but I think people are buying a lot of books these days because they have more time to read. I'm certainly reading a whole lot more. I'm writing a whole lot more. I'm not sure that's good, but you know, it's kind of turned us inside to in the house to spend more time reading.
I think it's actually true, and I think all the numbers bear that out. I mean, you know, every indie that I know is selling so much more online than they ever did. And they're supporting, you know, sometimes you don't know what you have until it's gone. And I think that's the case here as well. You've also been one of the great supporters of other writers too. I remember when we invited you last year, I guess, God, it seems like forever. Maybe it was 2 years ago at the Miami Book Fair. And you came, but you brought along your two friends, David Gran, do you remember?
Yeah.
And, it was David Gran and Hampton Sides. Hampton Sides was there as well. The three of you had a great, great time.
Yeah. A couple of other Doubleday writers, nonfiction guys who I love their books. And we had a wonderful time in Miami. And we're going to come back. Maybe this November, if we get to come back, who knows what's going to happen. But I was supposed to be in your store 2 weeks ago for Camino, for a big book signing and a big book party. And when I started touring 3 years ago with Camino Island, I did not tour for many years. And I went to 25 or 28 bookstores around the country. And wherever I would go, I would always try to get a local writer or two to come to the store. I would sign books and we would, you know, have a good time. Then we would have a program that we recorded on a podcast to have forever. And we had a wonderful time talking to other writers, the booksellers, and you know, we have a big crowd, the fans were there. The people in the bookstores, the buyers and readers really enjoyed it. And I had a wonderful time. And in the past 3 years, I've been able to meet people like John Irving in Toronto, Ian McEwan in New York, David Gran. I got really lucky in Louisville and met, I keep drawing a blank with these names. She wrote this.
she wrote the
murder
thing.
Mystery series. Sue Grafton. And we had a wonderful visit with Sue. We didn't know how sick she was, but she passed away a couple of weeks later. And I thought, well, you know, if I hadn't made the effort to go there, I would never have got to meet her. So it's I've got a list, James Lee Burke and people like that I want to get around and see Larry McMurtry and John Le Carre in London. And I plan to do it a lot more in the years to come.
Oh, you're in for a treat. You will love that. I mean, one of the things that was my thrill as an English major and someone who loved books, and as you say, we're the same age, is just being able to meet people like you. So just the way you're going to meet these other writers, the fact that we got to spend some time in Miami together. I think we went to Joe's and had some stone crabs. But I remember A Time to Kill. I was at a SEBA convention. And it was either in Nashville. I don't know where. Do you remember where your first SEBA convention was? Oh. Was it Nashville or Atlanta? I'm not sure.
I had two. I had one in Nashville and one in Orlando. I think that was with the firm. A Time to Kill was in Nashville. A long time ago.
I think it was with Nashville, and it was with your publisher, and you were at your table with that book. I think that the first printing was about 5,000 copies or something. And I remember you and I had a fairly long conversation because I had just left law school. I had quit law school to open up a bookshop, and you were talking about how you were still practicing law, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Talk about how A Time to Kill come about. A lot of people might not know.
Well, I had never written anything before. It was 1985 and I was 30 years old and I had never studied writing. I'd never dreamed of being a writer. It just, you know, I was going to be a lawyer or a judge. And was inspired by a courtroom drama, a live courtroom drama, to create this fictional story set in a small town in Mississippi, as played out through the eyes of an idealistic young attorney, very much like myself, who was struggling to survive in a small town with too many lawyers. And I just started writing the story, and it took 3 years of fairly hard work because I didn't know what I was doing. And my wife was a real supporter. She liked the story. I finally got the book written after 3 years and went about the process of trying to get it published, which was a typical submission, rejection, back and forth to New York, long before the internet. And this is 1987 by now, 88, I guess. And finally found an agent who liked the book, and he found a publisher that nobody ever heard of. And so they published the book in June of 89. 5,000 hardback copies, and it never went back for more. It was a total flop. It never went back for more. There was no paperback initially, no foreign rights, and the book just kind of languished and died a slow death. And I was disappointed. At the same time, I was got in the habit of writing every day, and I had another story I thought was far more commercial and accessible and popular, and I was writing it. That was The Firm, and The Firm came out in March of 1991, almost 30 years ago, and everything changed overnight.
Is it 300 million John Grisham books are in print? That's pretty amazing, huh?
I don't know who counts those. I've never met the person who counts those. I keep seeing that number. I'm not sure how accurate it is. It sounds good, but nobody really knows how many copies we sell in South Korea or Thailand. Right. We don't really know.
No, it's in like 42 languages now as well. It's pretty amazing. Really, really remarkable. You know, I have to tell you that as a bookseller, I really loved Camino Island. And you delved right in. It's based in Florida as well, northern, central Florida. But I just fell in love with it. And same with Camino Winds. In fact, that's the book that John is kind of publishing right now. This is Camino Winds. John, why don't you call it an entertainment. Tell me what you mean by that, and tell me why you decided to go this route. Because the two books before that, I'm not talking about Rooster Bar, but the other two had to do a little bit more with social justice and some of the issues that concern you. So were the Camino books a kind of Tupperware release for you, sort of?
Sure. Yeah. Over the years, I think I'd written probably about 10 legal thrillers, and I wondered if I could write something else, something maybe a little bit lighter, something that was not about capital punishment or wrongful convictions or all the issues I deal with. And so I wrote a childhood memoir called A Painted House. That was very different. No lawyers. And I wrote a football book called Bleachers. I wrote a comic novel called Skipping Christmas. And then 10 years ago, I started writing kids' books, a series. And so I've written a lot of those books now. I do the smaller books. They're a little bit lighter. Camino Island was intended to just be a good old-fashioned beach book, a pure entertainment, no lawyers, no issues, just pure fun. And by the time I finished Camino Island 3 years ago, I knew I was going back there for more stories. Camino Winds is number two. There will be a number three.
Oh, good.
Beyond that, I really can't see. But we vacation at Amelia Island, north of Jacksonville, for 25 years. That's our hangout. We love the place. And we built a house there 10 years ago, and we're trying to get there now for a couple of weeks. And so I had this idea for a story about some stolen books and stolen manuscripts, rare books, because I'm fascinated by the thievery in that business. I collect rare books, and I love to read about them, and I love to read stories. And so I was talking to my wife one day, and I said, how could I fashion a good old-fashioned mystery involving rare books? And that's where Camino Island came from. The island is very similar to Amelia Island, but not completely. The bookstore is basically Square Books in Oxford, set down there on Main Street in the town of Santa Rosa. And I had way too much fun with it. It's just a lot of fun to write. With Camino Winds, we're back on the same island as a hurricane approaches. And there's one of the local writers, and part of the good colorful part of Camino Island is a literary mafia. There are a bunch of writers there that hang out around the bookstore, around Bruce, the owner of the bookstore.
It's not unlike Square Books, right?
Oh, Mitch, when we moved to Oxford in 1990, Square Books was thriving. And Willie Morris was the writer in residence at Ole Miss. Barry Hanna was teaching at Ole Miss. Larry Brown had just broken out. And that's where I was hanging out most of the time at Square Books. And Richard back then, and still now, is on the national circuit. So all the writers come through Oxford. And I met dozens of writers, you know, hang out, ate with them, drank with them, you know, signed books with them. It was a great literary atmosphere in the early 1990s, and still is. But I'm gone, and all those, my friends are all dead now. But there's still there's even more writers in Oxford today than ever before. So it's a real literary community. And I love that feel of Camino Island, the writers get together. So during the hurricane in Camino Winds, one of them is murdered in such a way by a professional that at first they don't realize he's been murdered. And the police are too busy dealing with the aftermath of the hurricane. And so they don't really have time to investigate his murder. He's a friend of Bruce's. So Bruce and some buddies take off like the Hardy Boys to solve this murder mystery. And it's a murder mystery.
It's great. I don't want to talk about it because I don't want to put any spoilers in there, but everyone should run out and get it. In fact, we're going to have, John has signed some book plates. And if I was told by my social media people, and I don't know how this works, but if you go to our Books and Books heading and you click on that, there's a way for you to buy the book. Even today through Instagram Live. And we'll make sure that we include one of John's signatures on that as well. So that's great. I loved also the last, I loved The Guardians that you just wrote.
Right.
I thought that was tremendous, really tremendous. But then I also loved The Reckoning. I thought The Reckoning was so different for you. Did you feel when you were writing it that it was a different kind of book as well?
Oh, sure. Sure. It's the only book I've written, Mitch, that took place before I was born. So we were born, as we know, in 1955. But this was took place in 1946, back during the war. And it's that was a bit of a struggle or a bit of a challenge to do the research and get the setting correct. But it's a story of it's based on a story I heard 30 years ago. Someone told, and I overheard the story about a small town in Mississippi where one prominent man killed another and would never say why. He took the secret to his grave. He was executed, and he never told anybody why he did it. It's a long story, but they hung him for it in 1930 something. It's supposed to be a true story. I've not verified it. I've not found anybody. I can't remember who told the story, but I've always remembered that. And so that's what the book is about. And the mystery of why this one prominent man killed another one. And my challenge with The Reckoning was to take the reader all the way down to the last page before the reader knows why. And it was a challenge, but it was also...
You succeeded. It was riveting. I read it in one or two sittings.
Well,
it was really, really... And then the Guardians, which is dealing with wrongful convictions and
right.
You know, where did this sense of social justice? You grew up in the South,
right.
You grew up in Mississippi. You actually, if I'm not mistaken, you were involved in politics there too. You ran for state house.
Right.
So where did this sense of social justice come from in you?
Yeah, it's become more pronounced in the last, I think, 10 years. In 2006, I published a book called The Innocent Man, my only nonfiction book. And that the research of that book took me into the world of wrongful convictions. And I realized how many innocent people are actually in prison, serving long sentences or even on death row for somebody else's crime. And that still bothers me today. And I've been on that bandwagon for a long time. I hope I don't overdo it, but every wrongful conviction story is a fantastic story to tell because of all the injustice, because of the human suffering, because of the waste of time and human life and money and all that. And, you know, so the stories fascinate me, and I still, you know, I correspond today with several people who are in prison, who are innocent, and I try to be their friend, but it really bothers me. I'm on the board of the Innocence Project in New York, and active with the Innocence Project here in Virginia and Mississippi, and it's just a cause. It's just something I've really taken to in the past 15 years. So, and I also explore, you know, the death penalty and its problems, and mass incarceration, and sentencing disparities, and for-profit prisons. And there's so many problems, so many things wrong with our legal system that could be fixed if we had the will to do it, and we would save zillions of bucks and a lot of, you know, wasted human lives if we had the will to do it. And it's, as a lawyer, it's very frustrating still for me to see a problem in the system that we just not fixed, and therefore it leads to a lot of injustice. And that still makes me angry. And the anger is a good thing. The anger causes books like The Guardians. The anger makes me want to write about that issue, always in the context of a popular novel, always in the context of entertainment, first and most important. But the best books are when I take an issue like one of those I just mentioned and sort of weave a thriller through it and entertain the reader, but get the pages turning. And then when the book is over, maybe the reader can stop and say they learned something, or they care about something more, or whatever. That's what I do occasionally. And then I'll write the pure entertainments like a sports book, or a Camino book.
Well, you know, it's interesting on The Guardians. A very close friend of mine who's a retired lawyer actually approached the organization to volunteer based on reading your book. So it does have that effect.
Yeah.
And I think that's a wonderful way in. And having your voice out there, you know, as popular as it is, can effectuate change like nothing else, I believe. Yeah. You mentioned sports. So you wanted to be a baseball player, right? That's the legend.
A lot of ambition, not much talent. Every kid on my block, we were all going to play for the Cardinals. We used to get in fights about who was going to play what position for the Cardinals. We were 12 years old, and we knew every player. You know, I've always envied my big city friends now that I've met them, you know, guys in Boston, New York, Baltimore, Washington, who grew up with the team. They had a Detroit. They had a real right. team that they could go watch and play as a kid. Well, we were so far removed from that in rural Arkansas and rural Mississippi. But every night, the Cardinals were on the radio. Every game, we listened to every game.
Right.
I can vividly recall playing Little League Baseball as a 12-year-old, being in the dugout, hot summer night, and the bleachers, our parents and families and friends, everybody's at the bleachers. And you would hear three or four different radios scattered around with the Cardinals on. We always knew. We were playing a game. We always knew what the score was in the Cardinals game. That's what we live.
I bet we were in the same grade when we skipped school to watch Bob Gibson in the World Series, right? I forget what year that was.
1967, 1968. In 1967, he won three games against the Red Sox. And in 1968, right. against the Tigers, he struck out 18 in the first game. My mom, who was a strict disciplinarian, she called the school that afternoon, day game in Busch Stadium. She called the school and told the principal that I was not feeling well, so I could walk home about 10 minutes long to go home and sit in front of television and watch Bob Gibson strike out 18 Detroit Tigers. And I'll never forget that. Right. I grew up with a love of baseball and wanted to play.
Was that Denny McClain that he pitched against?
Yes, Mickey Lovelich. Yeah. 1960. Yeah. And the Tigers won that series.
They did. I remember, you know, being from Miami, we didn't have any teams here either, any baseball teams. So I just got to like anybody. I was lucky.
And Mitch, can you believe this? And this spring, we've had gorgeous weather here in Virginia. I have a Little League baseball park around the corner from my farm. We have seven fields. I'm the owner and commissioner. I'll give it to you if you want it. But we have we have 400 kids every year playing on 30 teams, and the ballpark is just beautiful, and there's nobody there. I love college baseball. There's nobody there, nobody, no games. The Cardinals aren't playing. It's baseball has always endured, you know, wars and depressions and everything, but now the pandemic has just killed us. You know, there's no baseball.
Yeah, well, they did say that if things loosen up a little, they may try to do a truncated season.
Yeah.
They're talking about 80 games or something. Yeah, we would – I'm with you. I miss that immensely. I'm a big basketball fan, too, and I miss that. Yeah. That was horrible to see that end. And I know you're a big football fan, too. You were so generous with your friends. You came down to the Orange Bowl last year, right? Because UVA was
– yeah. Virginia won 9 games last year and won their division in the ACC and qualified for the Orange Bowl, played Florida in the Orange Bowl. And we took a bunch of guys down and stayed at South Beach. And you were kind enough to get us a table at Joe Stone Crab again. And we had a great time there. And just loved the trip down. And, you know, it's January. It's warm down there and cold here. And we had a grand time.
So talk a little bit about how did you conceive – I know you're from Mississippi, so it might have been a little Faulkner-esque. But where did Ford County come from, the whole idea of Ford County?
Well, it was a fictionalized version of where I was living. I did not want to write, I didn't want to write about people I actually knew. I had to set the book somewhere. I knew it would be rural Mississippi. Rural, but, you know, we were only 15 miles south of Memphis, so we were not that far out. It was my courthouse that I described because that's where I worked almost every day as a young lawyer trying to be in the courtroom every day. And I knew the clerks and the policemen and the prosecutors, and that's where I'm from. And it's easy for me to write about that because of the culture, the food and customs and the way people talk. And it's just, that's where I would rather spend all my time as a writer. I'm writing a book now called A Time for Mercy. That's sort of a sequel to A Time to Kill. It's the same characters. It's Jake Brigance back in the courtroom. And I really enjoy that terrain, that turf. That's where I belong.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, this has been a time of a lot of loss in publishing particularly. And I think the last time we saw each other was at the memorial service for Sonny Maida. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about what he meant to you and what some of the publishing folks that you've dealt with over the years have meant to you as well.
Well, I was not close to Sonny. Sonny sort of inherited me 5 or 6 years ago when they folded Doubleday into Knopf. And I'm still with Doubleday. I've been with Doubleday for 30 years. But I've been so blessed with the business to have the same team at Doubleday. My agent, David Gernert, has been my agent for 25 years. He was my editor at Doubleday in 1990 when he bought the firm. David bought the firm in January of 1990. We're the same age, and we're still together, and we talked this morning. I have a great team around me there. Suzanne Hers is the publisher. John Pitts does the marketing. Todd Dowdy does the publicity. John Fontana designs the jackets. I mean, that's the art director, and many more. And they've been there for years. Publishing for me is never something to worry about because I've got the best people to do it. And they have my best interest at heart. And, you know, I listen to them. I listen to them a lot.
I think it's something that people don't realize, that this business that we're in, this literary business, it's really one gigantic family that everybody sort of cares about, looks after. Everybody feels like they're on a mission doing something more important than what it is we're doing. But ultimately it comes down to the book, and it comes down to, you know, giving something that somebody wants to read. It's a very low tech thing for us being in such a high tech world right now. So what are you reading? What are you excited about now?
I'm halfway through a great book, The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson, about the Battle of Britain and Churchill and Hitler. And it's I love reading about World War II. You saw that in The Reckoning, where I took off and went to the war in the Philippines for a third of the book. What am I reading? I'm rereading Salary's the Bones by Jesmyn Ward, won the National Book Award 10 years ago. I just finished Harlan Coben's latest book and enjoyed it. Finished James McBride's latest book, Deacon Kong Kong. James is a buddy and always fun to hang out with and a very, very good writer. I finished John Le Carré's last book. I read all of his books when they come out. He's one of my favorites. On the Nightstand is a book I'm eager to get to. It's called Hitler's First 100 Days. It's a story of when Hitler seized power in a very short period of time and became an absolute dictator. And he did so sort of with the approval of the German people. They bought in. And these were not, these people were not Nazis. They were not bad people, but Hitler was just took over. And it's, I haven't read the book yet, but I'm looking forward to reading that one. Scott Turow just came out last week with his latest. I get Scott's books as soon as they come out and read them. He's a friend, and I've always admired his writing. So I got a stack of books. I'm reading a lot.
Well, this gives us the time to do it, you know, just being all bottled up as we are. You are one of the greats, and someone that I am just so happy to have gotten to know over these last few years. I've always admired you greatly. The new book is Camino Wins, and everyone's got to do themselves a gigantic favor by buying it and reading it and all of that. John, I could talk to you forever. I assume you're off to another one of these events, but I thank you for this. It means a lot. You kept your word. You said you were coming down. Here you are.
I'm going to be there in the flesh as soon as I can, and we'll have a big party and go back to Joe's Stone Crab and hang out on the beach and have some fun. Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you, John. Be safe. My pleasure. And be well.
You be safe. Okay. Take care.